If Ivan Petrovich Pavlov were alive today, he would probably be prosecuted by the RSPCA. At the very least, he would have some anti-vivisection campaigner picketing his door. Because Pavlov was a scientist and used animals in his experiments, sometimes quite cruelly. I guess many of us will know his most famous experiment. He trained dogs to expect food whenever he administered an electric shock, say, to them. And then he studied their conduct when this pattern of training was disrupted. Sometimes he would leave a long gap between administering the electric shock and providing the food. Sometimes he would give a much larger voltage shock than usual. Sometimes he would mix the electric shocks up with other forms of stimulus in order to confuse the dog. Cruel as these investigations may have been, there's no disputing that they've become classics in behavioral psychology, and Pavlov made some most important discoveries as a result of them. Let me just mention to you this morning three things he found out. One thing he found out is that whenever a dog is submitted to excessive stress in this way, its conduct became disintegrated in a way that was startlingly similar to the kind of behavior that's observed in the case of nervous breakdowns among human beings. The second thing he discovered is that while dogs with an even temperament manage to resist this breakdown in behavior much longer than more highly strung animals, any dog submitted to enough stress broke down eventually. And the third thing he discovered is that whatever temperament a dog had, it was always much more vulnerable to breakdown when it was physically exhausted. Pavlov, in his later years, became absolutely convinced that much human mental illness was generated by this same kind of breakdown mechanism. And there's no doubt that psychology in our century has been immensely influenced by his views. I think most psychiatrists today would agree that there are limits to the usefulness of comparing human and animal behavior in that way, because our human responses are much more complicated than dogs. And to try to reduce all human behavior to issues of behavioral conditioning is probably grossly underestimating the subtlety of the human mind. But nevertheless, in spite of whatever inadequacies there may have been in Pavlov's theories, his experimental work was enormously revealing. It showed, if you like, how important it is for us all to take seriously the mental and emotional limitations of our human frame. A man may be a great deal more than a dog, but a man is still a creature, and he is still finite. And his nervous constitution, therefore, can still be overstressed. And when it is, no matter how basically stable or psychologically well-adjusted he may be, he will break down. And society in our decade is not short of examples to confirm the truth of that, is it? More and more men and women today are needing psychiatric treatment. Half the beds in our National Health Service are being taken up with such problems. And in a very high percentage of cases, Pavlov is right, it is stress that has been the trigger of the problem. Now, of course, you sometimes find people who will say, well, Christians should somehow be excluded from those growing statistics of breakdown. After all, they say, what about that promise in the Bible about the peace of God that keeps our hearts and minds? And up to a point, I think there is truth in that comment. Christians do have access to spiritual resources, which the non-Christian doesn't. And in times of emotional stress, those resources do make an immense difference to how we can cope. But it would be utterly naive, in my view, to think that Christianity can immunize anybody against nervous breakdown. For as Pavlov's experiments showed, the problem is basically one of our mental and emotional limitations. No matter what spiritual reinforcements we may be able to muster through prayer and the exercise of faith, being a Christian doesn't turn us into psychological supermen. We are still finite creatures with finite stress capacities. And if those capacities are exceeded, any one of us can break down, absolutely any of us, irrespective of how good a Christian we may be. Now, because that's so, it's part of our Christian responsibility to do our best to make sure that we ourselves live within those mental and emotional stress limits that God's providence has laid down for us, and that as part of our love for our neighbour, we see to it that others around us do the same. And this morning, our Bible study passage, I think, introduces us to some very simple measures, some simple precautions, which we can take in that regard. It's the most practical passage which the Holy Spirit in his wisdom has included in Scripture for our learning today. It represents two incidents in the life of Moses. Surely Moses must have been one of the toughest and most resilient characters in the whole of the Bible. And yet in these two incidents, we find him, Moses himself, on the very brink of collapse. And the reason in both times is the same. Sheer physical exhaustion. You remember what Pavlov observed. Whatever temperament a dog had, it was much more vulnerable to breakdown when it was physically tired. And there can be no doubt that the same is true of us. Of course, we need to work. Total inactivity brings mental problems of its own. But there is such a thing as overdoing it, and stress is 1,000 times more dangerous to any person, any workaholic who fails to realize that it's possible to overdo it. Now, you see, Moses had in recent days taken on huge leadership responsibilities, as we find him here in Exodus chapter 17 and 18. He was already president of Israel, minister of foreign affairs, and Archbishop of Canterbury, all rolled into one. And in chapter 17 and 18, we find him on top of all these tasks, we find him being burdened with the roles of commander-in-chief and high court judge, not to mention minister of food and water supply. There seem to be very few people in Israel who were able to take initiative for themselves. Perhaps decades of oppression had reduced them to a people who were used to being told what to do. And so this leadership structure had kind of automatically developed in the shape of an Egyptian pyramid, if you like, with Moses at the apex and everybody else looking to him for all the answers in every situation. And that same sort of thing can very easily happen to any group of people. Sometimes the leader allows himself to get into that position of indispensability because of his personal ambition. He doesn't want to share his rule with anybody. And the exercise of absolute control becomes a consuming lust for him. But perhaps more commonly than that, the very same situation results from rather the opposite tendency, from over-conscientiousness on the part of the leader. The responsibility of being in charge weighs so heavily on his mind that he dare not leave anything to anybody else in case they do it wrong. Whether it's motivated by ambition or over-conscientiousness, then, the consequence is that the leader has, as we say, a finger in every pie. He chairs every committee, he adjudicates every decision, and the end result is always the same. As the narrator observes in chapter 18, he wears himself out. Like a rocket soaring in the sky. Even the greatest leader has only a limited quantity of fuel on board. And once it's consumed, he burns out. That's the new phrase for this, you know. Burnout, I understand, on the other side of the Atlantic. And he falls like a stone, burned out. The story could be echoed thousands of times in thousands of situations. In politics, in business, but also in churches and in missions. Whatever happened to old so-and-so? Oh, hadn't you heard? He's had a breakdown. Yes, doctor says he's been overdoing it. Couldn't take the stress any longer. Well, now, what's the answer to this plague of nervous exhaustion in our day? Well, let me just draw three observations out from our study passage this morning, which may help us to understand why it was that Moses, though brought to the very brink of collapse on numerous occasions, survived the grueling demands of his task for 40 years. May be that we should be able to find application to our own lives from his example. The three observations I want to make are these. First of all, train up a successor to replace you. That's the implication of chapter 17, verses 8 and 9. Secondly, don't be ashamed to accept the support of others in a crisis situation. That's the implication of verses 10 to 16 of chapter 17. And finally, in the longest passage, do be willing to delegate. In chapter 18, very practical lessons. But then, the Bible's a very practical book. Maybe we shall learn that to our benefit this morning. Let's start then by training up a successor to replace you. That's the first measure we can take in order to avoid exhaustion. Look at verse 8 and 9 of Exodus 17. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Now, of course, so many people see the up-and-coming junior person as a threat, don't they? I guess many of you who work in industry have experienced the kind of rivalry that sometimes develops as a result of that tension. Don't you tell me what to do, young fellow, my lad. I was working here when you were still cutting your teeth. You know the attitude. And sometimes a similar attitude can be found in church. The older members distrust the younger generation, and as a result, the senior deacons or elders are unwilling to appoint more junior men to their number. It's the fear of the scrap heap, really, isn't it, if we're honest? The thought that one day we're going to get too old to do what we're doing now, and that when that happens, no one will want us, and we'll lose all our prestige. Things will be changed, but we'll no longer have the opportunity to influence those changes. Like the old bull elephant, we should be displaced by more vigorous young bucks as leader of the herd, and we should just have to go and hide somewhere and die. Well, though that's the unspoken fear, I think, that haunts many hearts when we get past that middle-age period, it doesn't have to be like that, does it? We don't have to be haunted by the fear of the next generation. Indeed, the prospect of retirement can be a perfectly comfortable one, even an attractive one, provided we plan for it and accept its inevitability. And Moses is showing us that here. He has the wisdom to plan for his own demise. He could have led the assault on the Amalekites personally. I suspect he might well have felt more secure in the victory if he had kept the reins of command in his own hands. But we see him here instead, for the first time, turning over a measure of responsibility to a junior lieutenant, Joshua. Much younger man, almost certainly a man with more military acumen than Moses himself, because Joshua does seem to have been a soldier rather than a statesman. And Moses has the shrewdness to recognize this young man's gifts and give him early opportunity for developing them. You choose the army, says Moses, and you lead them into battle. Was Joshua surprised by this sudden honor? I suspect he would have been even more amazed if he'd known what was really going through Moses' mind at the time, for there can be no doubt that Moses had already identified Joshua as his future successor. And that's why we read further down in verse 14, the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure Joshua hears it. See, already at this early stage in their pilgrimage across the desert, with 40 years of wandering still ahead of them, God is instructing Moses to give special attention to Joshua's political and theological education. You must write this incident down, Moses, he says, because one day your memory won't be enough. Write it down and make sure Joshua realizes the importance of what you're writing. The unspoken implication being one day you'll be gone, and he'll have the task of finishing this victory that you initiated today. Training up a successor, then, a vital step in avoiding that accumulating stress that can lead to breakdown. And we see it in many of the great men of the Bible. Elijah did it in training up Elisha. Jesus did it in appointing the disciples. Paul did it in appointing Timothy and Titus. It's not just important for the sake of the work. It's vital, too, for the mental welfare of the leader himself. Because, you see, inevitably, as we get older, our capabilities diminish. We don't like to admit it, but they do. Perhaps the quality of our work may be as good or even better, but the quantity is bound to decline. And there are many people who suffer from overwork for the simple reason they are trying to carry the same load at 50 they were trying to carry at 30, and it cannot be done. We must face up to our mental and emotional limitations. And one vital way to do that is to recognize the gifts of others and train them up in the conscious knowledge that they will increasingly take over from us. Dare I say, this is a particular application, you know, to many churches. If you look around this country, you will find dozens of churches that were once packed, but which now have only a handful in their congregation. There is a notable example not a great many steps from the doors of this chapel in this city. How does that come about? Oh, there are many reasons for the spiritual decline of churches, but there can be no doubt that one very practical and unnecessary reason is the failure of pastors to identify this vital principle of leadership. They don't find their successor. They accept a call to go elsewhere and give the church the statutory 3 months' notice. Or worse still, they hang on to the job and hang on to the job, getting older and older and less effective, while the work just decays around their ears. Well, let me make it plain, I'm not planning to resign just at the moment. Nor, I hope, have I reached that point of decrepitude yet. But it mustn't happen to Eden. We have a packed church this morning. It mustn't be that in 20, 30 years' time we're reduced to a handful again. But if we're going to avoid that, we must start thinking about succession in leadership. It's just blinkered not to do so. If Moses' example is anything to go by, even 40 years is not too long a preparation time for your pastor-elect to be waiting in the wings. So there may be something that we have to think about as a church there. Well, that's the first piece of wisdom from God's word then this morning about exhaustion. Train up a successor. If you're in any kind of leadership responsibility, train up a successor. Look for him and prepare him. The second piece of advice is this. Don't be ashamed to accept support in a crisis situation. Look at verses 10 to 12. Joshua fought the Amalekites, as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. And when Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side and one on the other, so that his hands remained steady till sunset. Now, opinions differ as to just what the significance of Moses' raised hands was. More liberal commentators have suggested the effect was purely psychological. It was a morale-boosting gesture to the Israelite troops. Others suggest it has some connection with primitive ideas of magic, that Moses was invoking a curse on the Amalekites by, as it were, waving his magic rod over the battlefield. But I think neither of these explanations really do justice to biblical religion, nor do they really fit in with verses 15 and 16. You see, Moses built an altar and called it, "The Lord is my banner." He said, four hands were lifted up to the throne of the Lord. It seems those verses are intended to be in some way explanatory of Moses' actions in raising his hands. Unfortunately, they too are rather obscure and disconnected. It doesn't make it clear what that explanation is. If we accept the translation of our New International Version, then the most likely interpretation is the traditional one. That is that Moses' hands were raised in prayer. His hands were raised to the throne of the Lord, petitioning him for his help in the battle. Alternatively, if we accept the verdict of many scholars who believe that the text ought to read, hands were lifted up to the banner of the Lord, rather than the throne of the Lord, then that would establish the connection between verses 15 and 16, and then it sounds as if Moses was, as it were, holding aloft some invisible flag on the mountaintop, the banner of Jehovah, rather as regiments today still carry their colours into battle. Only in Israel's case, the Lord was their banner. And so their flag was an invisible one. But either way, this gesture on Moses' part was symbolic of the fact that God was fighting for the Israelites. This battle was not won by human might, but by divine overruling. And for that reason, whatever the precise meaning of those raised hands, one thing is clear. They had to be Moses' hands. Nobody else's hands would do. God was by this means identifying once again the unique role which he'd called his prophet as mediator for the people. Moses didn't need to be a warrior to be their champion. For even as a spectator of the battle, this man was worth divisions. His intercession with God made the difference between winning and losing. And that, of course, as far as Moses personally was concerned, was the problem. There are some stress situations from which a leader cannot escape. No matter how much he might want to pass the buck, he can't. Nobody else's hands will do. That isn't necessarily arrogance. It's just a simple consequence of his special vocation. And in such a crisis situation, exhaustion is particularly dangerous. Because, as we've said before, no human being has infinite resources. We all burn out eventually. And if victory in the battle depends upon us not giving out, then the strain upon us can be almost unendurable. What's the solution to that kind of situation? Where you're in a stress-ridden situation and you can't get out of it, your hands have got to be the hands that are raised up. Well, the answer in that situation is support. We may not be able to shed the load, but we can find help in carrying it. And we mustn't be ashamed to accept support in such circumstances if we need it. That's what Moses is showing us here. Notice the support was of two kinds. There was physical support. They took a stone and he sat on it. And there was human support. Aaron and Hur held up his arms for him, one on each side. And the same is essentially true in every crisis situation. There are physical supports that we may need. It may be nothing more than a comfortable office chair in place of the old one that always gives us a pain in the back. It can make a very big difference to stress. Might be a holiday or a more regular day off. It's amazing how guilty some people feel about spending money upon relaxation. And let's be frank, it could also be a prescription from the doctor. Nobody wants to get dependent on pills, but sometimes drugs are a necessary support to get us through a crisis situation, when without them we would simply collapse, and we can't afford to collapse. But perhaps even more important than those kinds of physical supports for us, there is the personal support of other people. Often, of course, this support will be provided by members of our own family. It seems likely this was so in Moses' case. Aaron was his brother, and tradition says that Hur was Miriam's husband, and therefore Moses' brother-in-law. But if there is no family who can support us in these kind of crisis situations, then we must have one or two close friends to lean on, to share our troubles with, just talking with, as it were, getting them to stand on either side of us and hold our arms up as Aaron and Hur did. Perhaps I can say a special word to men here who are engaged in very responsible jobs in their careers. Now, there is nothing admirable about struggling on your own. This macho image of the rugged individualist has got to go. It's destroying people in our day. We are social creatures. It's vain to pretend otherwise. And in a stress situation, it's not just pompous to go on single-handed. It's foolhardy. We've got to have, each of us who have responsible jobs to do, an Aaron and a Hur to whom we can turn in a crisis situation. I'm not saying we have to share all our problems with everybody and anybody in the church, but there must be at least a couple of people who are utterly reliable, who will put the rock under our tired back and their shoulders under our tired arms when exhaustion threatens us. I'm quite convinced half the nervous breakdowns that happen could be avoided if those concerned would only admit they were getting near the end of the tether and look for help in time. And perhaps I can dare to say a word too to others of us here who may look on and see people in responsible jobs even though we haven't got them ourselves. Wives, perhaps. Friends. Keep an eye on those whom you know are in stress-ridden occupations. Remember Cain's question to God, "Am I my brother's keeper?" he said. Well, the answer, of course, is yes, you are. We all are our brother's keeper. You shall love your neighbour as yourself. If somebody you know breaks down and you've done nothing to try and stop it, you share part of the responsibility. Aaron and Hur's hands couldn't be raised to signal the victory. That wasn't their role, but they could be raised to support Moses' arms. And in their own way, their role was just as vital. If the battle had been lost as a result of their failure to do that, who would have been to blame? Moses? So you wives, be vigilant about your husband's mental and emotional resources. If he is doing too much, don't accept no for an answer. Go to the doctor, go to the friend, go to the pastor. In extremis, go to his boss if necessary. Insist that he ease up. And in the wider fellowship of the church, that kind of concern ought to be demonstrated amongst all of us. For those we know in our fellowship who carry heavy burdens, even the Moseses of this world need support sometimes. So that's the second very practical lesson about coping with the dangers of exhaustion that God teaches us here. But the third lesson embraces the whole of chapter 18, and it is this. Don't be afraid to delegate. Look at chapter 18, verse 1. Jethro, the priest of Midian and father-in-law of Moses, heard of everything God had done for Moses and for his people Israel, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Verse 5, Jethro, together with Moses' sons and wife, came to him in the desert where he was camped near the mountain of God. Now, if you've been following this series of studies, you'll be familiar with Jethro. Moses, remember, had stayed with him for a long while after his flight from Pharaoh early in his life. And while staying with this semi-nomadic clan in the desert, he had married Jethro's daughter, Zipporah, and had two sons by her. Opinions differ among scholars as to how much Jethro knew about the religion of Israel independent of Moses. He's described, you'll notice, as a priest of Midian. And some have speculated that, in fact, Jehovah was the name of Jethro's tribal deity, and that Moses actually learned his religion, not from the burning bush, but from his father-in-law. It's called the so-called Kenite hypothesis, and you'll read about it in books, those of you that ever read books these days. Well, it seems to me very difficult to interpret this passage along those lines, although it is a very popular line of explanation, particularly among liberal commentators. Those of you who were with us when we studied Exodus chapter 4 may remember that I suggested then an alternative reconstruction of this domestic situation in Moses' life. I'm quite sure myself that Jethro was a pagan priest, and that during his stay with Jethro, Moses too lapsed from the religion of his forefathers quite seriously. That's the only explanation I can find for the failure of Moses to circumcise his firstborn son, which we read about in chapter 4. After Moses' calling at the burning bush, however, and his decision to go back to Egypt, this new attitude on Moses' part put a strain on his relationship to Jethro and his family. And I suspect that is what lay behind the eventual breakdown of his marriage. You notice we read in verse 2 that Moses had sent away, the word has the flavor of divorce there, had divorced his wife. And Zipporah and her children had gone home, they'd gone back to Jethro to live with father. May well have been as a result of a domestic dispute about that circumcision issue that we read about in chapter 4. And that surely is why we've heard nothing more about Moses' marital family since that strange incident in chapter 4 right up until now, chapter 18. Well, if we're right about that kind of reconstruction of events, then these verses surely in chapter 18 represent a most moving occasion in Moses' life, don't they? After probably a number of years of separation, here is Moses being reconciled to his wife and reunited with his children. And it's quite clear what the reason was, why this was possible. Jethro's religious opinions had undergone a remarkable change. He had heard, we read, everything God had done for Moses and for his people Israel, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. A pagan Jethro may have been, but he was not a closed-minded pagan. No doubt when Zipporah had returned home, she told her father about the strange things that had happened to Moses and her family that had caused their breakdown. And Jethro, for all his theological ignorance, was sensitive enough to spiritual realities to perceive that something important was going on. And the more news that filtered back to him via the bush telegraph from Egypt, the more convinced he became that it wasn't disloyalty or irresponsibility that had caused his son-in-law to leave him. It was indeed the call of God, a God more powerful than any God Jethro had ever known, this new God with a new name, Jehovah, whom Zipporah told him about. Jethro was a very old man, surely at this time, but it seems he was determined to go and find out about this God for himself, even if it meant eating a little humble pie before his son-in-law. So the narrator records with touching detail their reunion here in verse 7. Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him, and they greeted each other. Moses told his father-in-law about everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians, and about all the hardships they met along the way, and how the Lord had saved them. And do you notice the response? Jethro was delighted to hear about all the good things the Lord had done for Israel in rescuing them from the hand of the Egyptians. And he said, "Praise be to the Lord who rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians and of Pharaoh. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods. There are many of us here, you know, who long that our parents should make just that same discovery. Again and again, I hear from young people who have found Christ here at Cambridge, the burden they carry for their families back home. And how difficult it is, isn't it, to communicate the good things the Lord has done for us to them. And how even more difficult it is for them to admit that their children may have discovered a dimension of spiritual experience that they themselves have never known. But if that's our situation, perhaps the story of Jethro can be an encouragement and a challenge to us. It is true. Sometimes when we find God in our lives, it does cause tensions in our families. It may even cause breakages in family relationships. Jesus warned us of that. But it is also true that the experience of God in our lives can reconcile them. And that's a very sweet event when it happens. The main thing I want you to notice about this chapter, though, is not Jethro's conversion, fascinating though that is. The main thrust of the chapter, which fits in with our general theme, is his advice. And that starts in verse 13. The next day, Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning till evening. And when his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, "What is this you're doing? Why do you alone sit as judge?" You know, one of the things we Christians are often bad at remembering is that wisdom is highly valued in the Bible. And wisdom, while it may be a divine gift, is not a gift which is monopolized by Christians. You read the book of Proverbs and you will quickly see that so-called common sense, secular wisdom, has a vital role to play in the life of any man or woman who wants to understand God's will for their life. Because the secular and the sacred are not independent realms in the Bible. God is the Lord of the world. And what we call common sense is his sense, too. He's a rational God. That's why, if we are wise, we shall not despise advice. Even when it comes to us from the lips of a person who, in spiritual terms, may be our junior by a considerable margin. Jethro was a new convert. But he was also a very wise and experienced old man. And something was obvious to him as a result of his experience as a clan chieftain, which it appears even somebody as spiritual and wise as Moses wasn't aware of. Namely, that Moses was overdoing it. And he knew where it would lead. "What you're doing is not good," verse 17. "You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you." Notice that twofold consequence of Moses' pyramidal style of leadership. You wear yourself out, he says, and you wear them out too, you and the people. It wears out the leader because, as we've said, nobody can bear unlimited responsibility. If Moses had continued as he was doing, I've no doubt, man of iron though he was, he would have worn himself into an early grave. And no doubt some very pious biographer would have written the moving story of how he burnt himself out for God. I've read some of those moving biographies. I'm always attacked by the nagging doubt that the stewardship of those lives would have been better served if they had a Jethro to advise them early on. Yeah. Most Christians, I fear, will quite cheerfully see their local missionary or their pastor work themselves to death and call it sacrificial service. But not only does it wear out the leader, it wears out the people too. You see, people are generally very willing to let one man carry the whole burden of leadership. It saves them from responsibility. But it does create resentment too. Things become inefficient. Men who have gifts have no opportunity to use them and so grow frustrated and critical. And when everybody's looking to one man to do all the decision making becomes slow. People grow irritated because nothing is being done about their concern. There's a famous case of Absalom in the Bible where a whole revolution was precipitated in David's kingdom because David didn't have the sense to see this. What's the answer? Well, the answer Jethro knew perfectly well. Delegation. "Listen now to me," verse 19. "I'll give you some advice and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to him. Teach them the decrees and laws and show them the way to live and the duties they're to perform. But select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties and tens. Have them serve as judges. for the people. It's something that every business executive and every pastor needs to understand. Delegation. It's a biblical principle. Notice the tactful way that Jethro suggests it. So many of us, when we want to suggest that Mr. X is perhaps trying to do too much, can't suggest it without somehow implying that Mr. X is not doing his job properly. No, Jethro has more tact, more discretion than that. Look, Moses, he says, yours is a teaching ministry. Your job is to explain to the people the general principles that guide their decisions, the great laws of God. You ought to expound this to the people. And if there are particularly difficult situations, then of course they must be able to call on you as counselor. But the bulk of day-to-day humdrum admin, that shouldn't be your burden. You should delegate that responsibility to others who can apply your teaching in specific situations. You'll be healthier as a result, and the people will be less garrulous. Great delicacy in the way he expresses it. And notice, too, the quality of men that he advises Moses to appoint. They are to be competent men, able. They're to be spiritual men, men who fear God. They're to be reliable men, trustworthy. Most of all, they are to be morally minded men, men who hate a bribe, men who hate dishonest gain, he says. These are the qualities which experience had taught Jethro to value in leadership. He's not so bothered about cleverness or family status or education or wealth or ambition or even of enthusiasm. Jethro had learned that what counts are solid qualities of character and morality and religion. Not a whiz kid, but a good man. Not a high flyer, but a steady worker. Not a first in law, but the fear of God. These are the things he says that count. Too often, of course, the church, fooled by brightness and intelligence and the general atmosphere of our day where qualifications count for so much, puts a premium on bits of paper or on charismatic personality. Well, there is much to learn here about the sort of man God wants. You think of the disciples Jesus chose, hardly a bunch of the sort of individuals you would expect a personnel manager to select as leaders for some great and important enterprise. But they were the right people, because they were the kind of people that Jethro is suggesting here. Trustworthy, spiritually minded, honest people. I think there is a very direct word of application to us in this church here, in this whole question of delegation. You know, we are becoming a big church. I know there are plenty bigger, but by many standards we are quite a large congregation now. And we are certainly at the point where we need to hear Jethro's advice. Many Baptist churches in our country have for a long while labored under this kind of pyramidal structure with the monarchical pastor to whom everybody looks on every occasion. A kind of Baptist pope. Well, if we don't think in terms of delegation and team ministry, what happened to the Israelites will happen to us. We will start wearing out pastors, and we will start wearing out the people. Now, the pyramid has to go. Jethro's advice for us is a very practical one. It will mean changes. It means that we are not going to be able to always be ministered to by the pastor. We just can't accept that when we become a large congregation. It means we have got to look for leaders. Notice the smallest unit here. Rulers of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Every group of ten had a judge in Israel. Somebody they could go to help them sort out their problems. How many leaders then do we need here? This is what our house groups are about. That's why they are so important. Because it is within the house groups that our pastoral ministry has to take place as we become a larger congregation. And the role of the elders is to see to it that the great general principles of God's word are faithfully taught and that difficult situations are handled well. But we desperately need people such as Jethro recommends, capable men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, who can be appointed as judges for our people. It's a biblical principle that we must start to apply. We mustn't be afraid to delegate. Well, there it is then, exhaustion in the leadership and how to avoid it. Train up a successor. Don't be ashamed to accept support when you need it. Be willing to delegate. simple advice, common sense advice, you may say. But then common sense advice can still be God's advice. If the advice is so simple and so common sense, why is it that so many breakdowns from nervous exhaustion still occur? Shall I tell you what I think the answer is? One big answer, anyway. Look back at chapter 17 again. Moses built an altar, verse 15, and called it, "The Lord is my banner." Look at 18, verse 24. Moses listened to his father-in-law and did everything he said. I believe there's a connection between those two verses. It would have been only too easy, wouldn't it, for Moses, who had led this people in a triumphant way out of Egypt, to treat his father-in-law with contempt, or at least condescension. "I'm the freedom fighter, what do I need your advice for?" But that wasn't his attitude. And you know why? Because the Bible tells us Moses was a meek man. More humble than any man on the face of the earth, it says. And that's the quality, you see, that we need to have if we're to avoid exhaustion. So often, the nervous breakdown is the result of us being unwilling to shed our pride, unwilling to admit that we can't cope. So we cling on and we struggle on till collapse comes, pushing ourselves neurotically and obsessively to the very limit. We'd rather commit suicide than admit failure. Where does such humility come from? It comes from whenever you go, wherever you go, whatever victories you achieve, whatever successes come your way, building altars. "The Lord is my banner." That was the secret of Moses' meekness, the meekness without which he couldn't have survived the strains of his task. He was a humble man because he was a worshipping man. The danger for so many of us in these secular and materialistic days in which we live is that our busyness, our ambition, our competition drives out worship from our lives. If we don't live in the shadow of a great God, we will not cope. Pride will eat us up. Many who break down under the pressure of overwork are simply paying the price for seeing their lives as an ego trip rather than as a pilgrimage. My advice to you is, make sure you're not one of them. Let's pray together, shall we?